that if Dan could encounter the living God, he could gain needed perspective on the rest of his life. Yes, sorting out his housing was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. Yes, making sure he had food to eat was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. Yes, securing his safety by going to an addictions counselor was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing, according to the rhythms of Jesus, was carving out time for God. But really, what time-pressed professional wants to do that? Dan had spent decades lauding efficiency, mandating quick fixes, expecting expediency from all of life, and yet now he faced a dilemma that couldn't be quick-fixed or get-her-done-healed. Intimacy happens in private, something Jesus knew all too well. This is why he'd scurry away from the crowds and seek out a mountainside where he could be alone. Resting in God is like a series of date nights with your spouse, during which logistics is not the only topic discussed. "When was the last time you had an intimate moment with God?" I asked Dan before we ended our call. He quietly exhaled, collected his thoughts, and said without fanfare, "See you Sunday at church." Dan did come to church. He sat right beside me, there on the front row, and he sang the songs and bowed his head during the prayers and allowed me to place my hands on his shoulders after the service and ask God for his peace to utterly invade Dan's life. Although he would call himself a Christian, Dan would also readily admit that he's never really walked with Christ. He's never leaned into the peace of his Father and allowed his Father's voice to determine his steps. I'd never wish devastating circumstances on anyone, but as I watch Dan navigate this season of his life, I can't help but wonder if God is allowing the pain so that something beautiful can be born, something that sniffs of long-awaited, desperately needed peace. The Jesus pace is resolute. You could make a case that I have no business pursuing the third part of Jesus' pace until I pass the test on parts 1 and 2. But because I'm a glutton for punishment, I stay at my desk, continue to excavate his lifestyle, and keep on jotting down lessons I've yet to learn. Here's the final one I make note of. There's resoluteness to his rest. I'm reading in the book of Mark, chapter 4. After a full day of teaching, Jesus, along with his disciples, is on a boat crossing the Sea of Galilee toward the eastern shore. Evidently, without warning, a huge storm erupts, causing waves to pour into the boat and causing the disciples to think they will sink. This happens to make sense to me. If I was on a flight that was going down, I would pray, and if I was on a boat that started to pitch and roll, I would start planning my own funeral too. So the storm is surging all around, the disciples are scared out of their minds, and there is Jesus asleep in the stern. His otherwise happy followers are infuriated. "Is it nothing to you that we're going to drown?" they scream as Jesus snoozes away. Finally, he wakes up and surmises the situation and, without any pomp and circumstances, shouts, "Quiet! Settle down!" Verse 39. He was talking not to the disciples, but astonishingly, to the wind and the waves. More astonishing still, the wind and the waves complied. Mark 4, verse 39 says, "The wind ran out of breath. The sea became smooth as glass." Wow! Such confidence, such resoluteness, such an awareness of kingdom come. But Jesus is simply stunned by the disciples' lack of faith. "Why are you such cowards?" verse 40, he asks, taking in the wide-eyed and white-knuckled bunch. The disciples now stagger around not from seasickness, but from sheer awe in the face of this man. "Who is this anyway?" they ask, according to verse 41. "Wind and sea at his beck and call." Try all of creation at his beck and call. Here's the thing we tend to miss. When Jesus declared peace and quiet, he wasn't declaring it over a single storm. He was declaring it over an entire kingdom. He was saying, in effect, "Peace and quiet will one day reign, everywhere at all times. At some point, the lion will lie down with the lamb. Predator and prey will live at peace." Interestingly, the Bible never says that the storm that day was caused by Satan. Most likely it was a naturally occurring storm. Still today, sudden storms can rise up over the mountains of that very region and quickly throw into massive turbulence the otherwise mild Sea of Galilee. This wasn't Satan trying to kill them then. This was the natural order of things. And what Jesus was saying is that, yes, this is normal and natural for now, but a new normal is on its way in. When my kingdom settles in, all things will be at rest. What's more, by accusing the disciples of being cowards, he was indicating to them that an unyielding, unwavering confidence could be theirs instead, that they could enjoy that state of rest whenever they chose. This is something they didn't know, and something we have a hard time believing still today. Peace is ours for the taking. It's always knocking on the door. We simply have to open the door and invite it in. We have to be open for business, remember? This is such a fantastic goal. I was starting to understand why Jesus chose to live the way he did. Pace matters. The right pace matters. Perhaps there is hope for me yet. Breaking busy. Challenge. Practice the Jesus pace. The Jesus pace is rhythmic. Take a look at your schedule for tomorrow, keeping in mind Jesus' propensity to engage, 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 and then withdraw. In the course of tomorrow's plans, where will you withdraw and allow yourself to rest? Go ahead and block the time or times now so that you're sure to honor them when they show up. Maybe you have 15 minutes alone during your morning commute or en route to collect a child from school. Maybe you typically have an hour in the afternoons when your children are napping. Maybe you have the ability to hole away in your office at work for 10 minutes at the beginning or end of a lunch break. Decide now when you will withdraw, and then tomorrow, commit to doing just that. The Jesus pace is relational. Specific quiet times alone with God are great, but even greater is a constant flow of communication over the course of a given day. Just for tomorrow, see if you can't raise your awareness of His presence and His power, and then chat with Him as you go about your day. Tell Him what's on your heart as you walk from one meeting into the next. Ask Him for discernment as you engage in conversation with a friend or associate. Invite God to correct any errant thinking of yours as you reflect on that performance review with your boss. Thank Him for the blessings you enjoy in life, your spouse, your kids, your job. Practice chatting with God all throughout the day and see if the interactions don't work wonders for your spirit by the time you lay your head down that night. The Jesus pace is resolute. As you walk through tomorrow's agenda, insist on choosing peace. When your toddler is throwing a tantrum, take a deep breath and simply choose peace. When your boss is demanding an impossible deadline, simply choose peace. When there is traffic and construction and the guy behind you is laying on his horn, choose peace. When the annoying family member calls or the needy friend texts, take a step back from the situation and determine in your heart to choose peace. Say the words aloud if that helps you. I choose peace. But whatever you do, make peace your choice. Chapter 7. Choosing My Vine. I'm afraid of losing my obscurity. Genuineness only thrives in the dark, like celery. Aldous Huxley. Let's talk about me. 10 minutes into the requested breakfast meeting, I regretted having said yes. The young man who had asked for the get-together, he needed some pastoral coaching evidently, was sitting across from me at the diner, and now there at the restaurant, with my full attention pointed his way, he had the gall to check his smartphone what seemed like every 16 seconds. He checked it while I was ordering my meal. He checked it just after he ordered his meal. He checked it while I answered his questions, and he even checked it while he asked them. Unless the guy was waiting on word of an organ transplant, which I quickly learned he wasn't, his lack of focus was totally unacceptable. My irritation quickly birthed a fury that made me cut the meeting short, and I bolted. The world of psychology has a term for this annoying phenomenon of neglecting to pay attention to the person or situation immediately in front of you, choosing instead to see who else is doing something interesting or what else is going on. FOMO, it is called, otherwise known as the fear of missing out. FOMO is what causes us to text while driving, interrupt one call to take another, check our Twitter stream while on a date or at a breakfast meeting with our pastor. In short, we do these infuriating things because something more interesting or entertaining just might be happening. I'm convinced that some of us could experience a visit from Jesus himself, live and in the flesh, and yet still we'd brazenly stick an index finger in the air and say, "Hang on, Jesus, let me check my Facebook wall real quick." There is an underlying fear motivating all this craziness. We don't just want to be in on other people's excitement. We want them to find us exciting too. We want to be seen and heard and recognized and admired. We so desperately want someone to care. But what's interesting is that when we shout along with hundreds of millions of others who are shouting, still we cannot be heard. Our voices are simply lost in the others' me-focused cacophony of sound. Missing out on Christ. After having considered the pace Jesus lived by, I arrive at an early conclusion. Jesus didn't know FOMO very well. Actually, I don't think he knew it at all. What concerned him was not being included on all the right lists, being retweeted by all the right handles, being known by all the right names. What concerned him was being hidden away in the character of his Father, and from there, living life at peace. John chapter 15 contains a fascinating and interesting metaphor along these lines. Jesus was talking to his disciples and explained his relationship to them in agricultural terms. "I am the real vine, and my Father is the farmer," he said. "He cuts off every branch of me that doesn't bear grapes, and every branch that is grape-bearing, he prunes back so it will bear even more. You are already pruned back by the message I have spoken." Verses 1 through 3. He then went on to say exactly how this fruit bearing was going to occur. "Live in me. Make your home in me just as I do in you. In the same way that a branch can't bear grapes by itself, but only by being joined to the vine, you can't bear fruit unless you are joined with me." Verse 4. So it's not that we are expected to live the Jesus pace alone. He is the one who will get us there. He is the band leader in our quest for rhythmic lives. "I am the vine," the passage continues. "You are the branches. When you are joined with me, and I with you, the relation intimate and organic, the harvest is sure to be abundant. Separated, you can't produce a thing. Anyone who separates from me is dead wood, gathered up and thrown on the bonfire. But if you make yourselves at home with me, and my words are at home in you, you can be sure that whatever you ask will be listened to and acted upon. This is how my Father shows who he is, when you produce grapes, when you mature as my disciples." Verses 5 through 8. As it relates to our present-day plague of FOMO, here is what I think Jesus is saying in these verses from John 15. You're only missing out if you're missing out on me. Obscurity and why we abhor it. The Bible tells us just after Jesus was installed in public ministry, he was sent to the backside of the desert by God. Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 through 17 tells the story of John the Baptist baptizing people in the Jordan River when Jesus shows up. He wanted John to baptize him, the text says. John objected. "I'm the one who needs to be baptized, not you." But Jesus insisted. "Do it. God's work, putting things right all these centuries, is coming together right now in this baptism." So John did it. The moment Jesus came up out of the baptismal waters, the skies opened up and he saw God's Spirit, it looked like a dove, descending and landing on him. And along with the Spirit, a voice. "This is my Son, chosen and marked by my love, delight of my life." This was a monumental deal. God is finally raising up his Son as the Messiah, the long-awaited one, the pretty big deal, if ever there was one. Everyone watching that day surely understood the significance of this event. And yet, instead of then launching a website, rallying donors, hiring staff, buying a building, or feeding a public relations frenzy, Jesus simply hid away a while. This seems counterproductive, doesn't it? Shouldn't he have, I don't know, made a bigger splash? Evidently, the answer was no. Per his father's instruction, Jesus willingly left for a 40-day trek in the desert. I've actually been to the part of the world where Bible scholars believe Jesus went during that time, and it is so desolate that it makes the sand dunes of western New Mexico look like a lavish, lush Hawaiian island. It was barren with a capital B. So, it wasn't just that Jesus withdrew, or even when he withdrew, but also where he withdrew to. He schools us at every turn. For Jesus, though, this was nothing new. Granted, Jesus' birth was widely publicized, and we do know from Scripture that around age 12, he was left behind at the temple long after his parents' caravan began the long trip home. But for the most part, the first 30 years of our Savior's life were lived in obscurity. Author Constance Rhodes reminds us, Jesus is the great I am. He is not the great I do or the great I will. His life began with an almost total silence that lasted for 30 years. And then when he finally began his public ministry, many people were disappointed that he didn't do bigger, more far-reaching things. They expected him to become the King of Israel, to set everything right everywhere. Instead, he healed sporadically and taught how to live everyday life. There were no big Jesus heals them all conventions. While he did the occasional large-scale miracle, such as feeding the 5,000 and healing all the sick in a village, for the most part, it was a crippled guy here, a bleeding woman there, a demoniac at the edge of town. And then, strangely, Jesus asked many of these people to keep it to themselves, not to let the word get out that he had healed them. His disciples must have wondered why a guy with so much power didn't do more with it. In short, Jesus was at home, not being seen. The Bible frequently uses a device called typology, in which various people, events, institutions, ceremonies, or other things are used to illustrate some truth. One thing is used as a type and a shadow of something else. In the Old Testament, for example, both the prophet Moses and King David are intended to be types and shadows of Christ. Not surprisingly, before both men are raised up as the great leaders God has asked them to be, they are found on the backside of the desert, making their home in obscurity. Frankly, this is information we don't really want to know. We don't care all that much about the stagehands who scurry about in the shadows, dressed in black so they won't be seen, or about the backup singers to the main act. If there's a reason we prize our social media structures, it's because they allow us to be seen, to be heard, and to be adored. This is what we're after, isn't it? We want to know not how the hidden have stayed hidden, but rather how the star rose, how the winner won, how the hero saved the day. We are deeply conditioned to choose the heroic over the saintly, wrote Brian Zond. We love our heroes best of all. He goes on, heroes are goal-oriented people of great capabilities who know how to make things happen. We admire their ability to get things done and shape the world according to their will. Saints, on the other hand, especially to the American mind, seem quaint and marginal, occupying religious spheres on the periphery of the action. We want to be heroes. We don't really want to be saints. The difference between the heroic vision and the saintly vision is a fundamentally different way of viewing the purpose of life. We want to conquer the world and have everybody know about it. We don't want to be obscure. You and I both have a little group of people where we fit in, where we belong, where we tend to know the score, where we are, in our minds at least, a pretty big deal. To be ostracized and hidden away, to feel like we're missing out on something, is a real challenge, regardless of who we are. And yet it is here, in obscurity, where we're actually most likely to thrive. Jan Johnson said, we were built for times of hard work and outward expression, but also quiet hiddenness. We must have them both. Crops grow better with a Sabbath. Animals labor better with a Sabbath. To pause and to know that God is wisdom. And so we find that in order to live our lives rhythmically, in order to be Sabbath-keeping, bedhead day observing kinds of people, we have to periodically hide ourselves away. Back to John chapter 15. Each time I read this passage, I feel as though Jesus is holding up a mirror to my heart and saying, "Here, this is what your motives really are." The heart can be deceptive. We know from Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. We can twist our motives and lie about our true intentions and generally fool the world. We can do these things, but we don't have to. We don't have to live that way. We can live lives of truth, lives of transformation, lives at peace. We do these things by staying attached to Christ. John chapter 15 is here to remind us that the spiritual maturity we long for comes only by way of a certain privacy between God and us. It comes only when we quit clawing for control and learn to rest in the enoughness of God. I've discovered firsthand that it is a learned behavior as opposed to a skill we simply drift toward. After Pam and I left ministry in Shreveport, Louisiana, and relocated to Amarillo, Texas, where I went back to work in radio, I knew in my heart that I would pastor again one day. I wasn't completely sure I wanted to, but I knew deep down that I would. When you're called by God to do something, you're generally aware of what that something is. I knew for sure I'd been called. Because of the certainty of my call, as soon as we got ourselves settled in West Texas, I began volunteering at a thriving church nearby. They needed help in their singles department, and so that's the group I chose to serve. Under my leadership, the ministry grew quickly, so much so that one day one of the members of the pastoral staff approached me to say that he and several other senior leaders were leaving that weekend for a ministry retreat, and that one of the items on their list of discussion points centered on hiring me to serve full-time, on staff, as the pastor to the singles group. I was honored, but not all that surprised. I knew how well the department had been doing, and also knew, as I've mentioned, that God wanted me to pastor again. You can imagine my shock, then, when this pastor returned from the retreat, asking for a meeting with me, and then proceeded to tell me I wasn't getting the job. I didn't show my cards to him, but inside, I was crushed. I wanted the role. I deserved the role. And I had no doubt I was going to be offered the role. Had I been a betting man, I would have gone all in on my being the guy. Not knowing what else to do, I kept walking the same path I was on, working in radio, serving at that church, waiting for things to come to me instead of pushing down doors left and right. It was challenging, this intentional relinquishing of control, but despite a fair amount of kicking and screaming inside, I knew it was the right thing to do. A few years later, the tiny church in Hereford, Texas, came calling and asked if I would serve as the senior pastor. I was excited to say yes, but there were aspects of the job that certainly would put me on the backside of the desert. I would be serving in obscurity. Was I really okay with that? I did say yes to the role, and Pam and I did move to Hereford. And it was indeed like living on the backside of the desert. But we were happy. We were at peace. We were doing what God had asked us to do. Ironically, it was when I was there in that desert place that a man named Robert Morris came to serve as guest speaker one weekend at our tiny church. He and I stayed in touch after that weekend, and we became fast friends. Eventually, it would be Robert who would hire me to serve with Gateway Church in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and from there, I'd be asked to serve as the senior pastor at New Life in Colorado. But my point is that I might never have met Robert had the church in Amarillo hired me to be the singles pastor. The role would have given me greater visibility and would have carried a little more prestige than was attached to the Hereford opportunity. But then I wouldn't have had the benefit of being in the desert for a while, of hiding myself away in God. In his book Prototype, Jonathan Martin wrote, "The only real antidote to the clamor of the crowd is time in the wilderness, where our true identity can be established and we can hear the still, small voice of God." The Spotlight as Cunning Adulteress. Cycling back to Jesus' experience, I find it intriguing that after spending 40 days in the desert, Jesus returned to Galilee powerful in the Spirit. and news that he was back spread through the countryside. He taught in their meeting places to everyone's acclaim and pleasure. Luke 4, verses 14 through 15. It's that last part that gets me, the part about his teaching being so well received. If there is one thing we can be sure of from the Scriptures, it is that Jesus lived a sinless life. By extension, this means that he never was boastful, arrogant, or proud. And yet we learn here in Luke that he got all sorts of accolades for bringing down the house when he taught. Moreover, we know from our previous discussion that he often voluntarily withdrew to spend time with God. I think these two things are connected. I think being able to handle praise well in public has a lot to do with embracing obscurity in private, with periodically hiding oneself away in God. It's a good test, that of seeing how well you do when you're praised publicly, as a determinant of how faithful you've been to hole away with God. Does praise puff out your chest, elevate your self-concept, and make you start to believe your own press? Or does it remind you whose power you're really operating on, the divine set of shoulders on which you truly stand? We typically overrate ourselves here. We think we, of all people, can handle praise exceptionally well. Just try us, really, you'll see. We beg God for opportunities we're sure we're ready for, big league chances to finally show our stuff. To which our loving Heavenly Father says to each of us, "No, no, child. Chase after anonymity instead. If promotion is ever right for you, then at the right time, I'll raise you up. I'll provide the avenue for public praise." The spotlight is a cunning adulteress. We don't believe this, but it is true. But because we don't believe it is true, we continue tooting our own horns, because we fear God will slack off on his promise to promote us at the right time, we insist on promoting ourselves. When Pam and I were first married, we were part of a class at church comprising both singles and couples who were roughly our same age. One of the members of that class was a young woman who was very passionate about her relationship with God. She was missions-minded and always seemed to be serving or giving or doing, all in the name of Christ. She fit the Southern stereotype of hair that was always done, makeup that was always flawless, and clothing that always matched, which is why it was noticeable when she showed up to a class dinner party one night with no makeup and gross, greasy hair. Of course, we had to ask what had happened to her that would cause her appearance to so radically shift. Had she been on a week-long camping trip? Had she run out of shampoo? Somebody posed the question we were all dying to ask, and she answered, "Oh, well, I am fasting this week, and based on the Scriptures, we are supposed to put oil on our heads whenever we fast." The verses she was referring to are found in Matthew chapter 6. "But when you fast," verses 17 and 18 read, "put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." Context is helpful here. In Jesus' day, to put oil on one's head and wash one's face was the equivalent of our saying, "Get out of bed, clean up, get dressed, go on about your day as you normally would." What Jesus most definitely was not saying was, "Draw attention to yourself and to your sacrificial ways." No, he much prefers subtle types. We don't prefer subtlety ourselves. We struggle to tithe because it costs us money. We struggle to pray because it costs us time. We struggle to fast because it costs us focus. And we struggle to do anything that is costly for God if we aren't sure we'll be recognized for it somehow. Oh, sure, we'll do the thing, but then we'll burn with the need to tell somebody, to review why all this godly grease is all over our hair. We'll refuse to rest until the points get put on our scoreboard, until everyone who may be watching knows just how awesome, with a capital A, we are. In terms of our strong suit, subtlety isn't it. We tend to mock the Pharisees of old, and yet we're more like them than we care to admit. They were an impressive religious people who knew the first 5 books of the Bible by heart. They wore spiritual fervor like a beloved coat and were known to pray, literally, all the time. They probably never missed church. They probably were never even late for church. They followed the law of Moses perfectly, a reality that ought to give us pause. For all our self-promoting grandstanding, have we ever done anything perfectly in all our lives? The fact is, even the most noble among us would have been in awe of the Pharisees. This was an impressive group of people. And yet Jesus was unimpressed. Why? Because their motives had gone awry. They wore their spirituality not in order to gain intimacy with God, but so that they'd gain favor with people. Jesus said, "I appreciate your diligent efforts, but I'm afraid you've missed the point." Earlier in Matthew 6, we read this, "Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Verses 1 through 4. I don't know about you, but I can barely get past that first line without sinking hip deep into self-reproach. Honestly, I can't conceive of a world in which I don't call attention to myself. Our entire social media structure is predicated on the idea of calling attention to ourselves. Sure, we can cloak it in all sorts of noble things, prayer requests and praise reports, and giving God glory for the good things He has done. But if we're not extremely careful, what we'll be doing is building our own followership instead of His. True, God says that we are to let our light shine so that people will see our good works and glorify our Father in heaven. And despite appearances on the surface, this is no contradiction to His advice to do all good deeds in secret. What He's saying is to give our motives some thought. Our intentions are to be so pure, so innocent, so Godward in their direction, that others will know intuitively it's Christ we're living for. Still, the question remains, can we tweet the stuff we want to tweet or not? I'll leave that to you and God. Yes, testimonies of God's goodness require a voice to speak them. See Romans 10, verse 14. But perhaps we can do better about running our testimonies through a motivation checkpoint first. Are we speaking, posting, tweeting, or otherwise broadcasting things so that people will be impressed with us, or so that they'll be impressed with our God? The blessing, Jesus says, comes to those who seek to hide themselves away. What we find on the desert's backside. The idea of being sent to the backside of the desert used to terrify me. What would I miss while I was gone? But at some point, my perspective did shift. And these days I'm finding myself actually craving that time away. The wilderness is becoming my home as much as my study or my back porch, whether for a moment between meetings on a busy workday, or for an entire week while decompressing on the heels of an intense season of ministry, I go there and inevitably I learn things about God and about myself while hidden away in His loving arms that I don't seem to learn any other way. Deserts, silence, solitudes are not necessarily places, but states of mind and heart, wrote Catherine de Hewick Doherty, founder of the Madonna House Community. These deserts can be found in the midst of the city and in the everyday of our lives. We need only to look for them and realize our tremendous needs for them. They will be small solitudes, little deserts, tiny pools of silence. But the experience they will bring, if we are disposed to enter them, may be as exultant and as holy as the one God Himself entered. For it is God who makes solitude, deserts, and silences holy. Precious excavations are made in obscurity. These don't get made while on stage. When I stay attached to the vine of Christ, I sense the Lord's pleasure uniquely. There I'm reminded who I am. I'm reminded whose I am. I'm reminded it's okay to leave my promotion in His capable hands. Luke 14 tells of a time when Jesus went to a top Pharisee's house for dinner. Jesus was seated among an entire group of religious scholars when He decided to tell them a story about a dinner party not unlike the one they were enjoying then and there. When someone invites you to dinner, he said, don't take the place of honor. Somebody more important than you might have been invited by the host. Then he'll come and call out in front of everybody, you're in the wrong place. The place of honor belongs to this man. Red-faced, you'll have to make your way to the very last table, the only place left. When you're invited to dinner, Jesus continued, go and sit at the last place. Then, when the host comes, he may very well say, friend, come up to the front. That will give the dinner guests something to talk about. What I'm saying is, if you walk around with your nose in the air, you're going to end up flat on your face. But if you're content to be simply yourself, you will become more than yourself. Jesus then turned to the host, a Pharisee, and said, the next time you put on a dinner, don't just invite your friends and family and rich neighbors, the kind of people who will return the favor. Invite some people who never get invited out, the misfits from the wrong side of the tracks. You'll be and experience a blessing. They won't be able to return the favor, but the favor will be returned. Oh, how it will be returned at the resurrection of God's people. Verses 8 through 14. I had the joy of watching this type of thing play out in the life of our worship pastor last year. The thing John was curious if he could let go of was not a grudge or a high-calorie dessert. It was fame, or maybe, at a minimum, prestige. The trouble is, the guy is great. He is a great singer, a great band leader, a great songwriter, a great all-around talent. And, candidly, he is actually starting to believe that he's great. Not in an egocentric way, but in a way that says he understands honest self-assessment. He understands what anointed songwriting looks and sounds like, and he understands the impact thoughtful, God-honoring work has on Christendom. One of John's longtime musical heroes is Martin Smith of the British Christian rock band Delirious. An occasion presented itself last fall for John to sit across from Martin one-on-one and have an earnest conversation about music making, about spirituality, and about success. And during that discussion, the topic of John's future came up. In classic John style, he was hedging his bets. He is humble, as the day is long, and yet he was aware there, as the conversation unfolded, that most likely he was facing a crossroads. His work was becoming known around the country, really all around the globe. But he had local church responsibilities here at home. Should he leave church leadership and tour full-time? He was already on the road a substantial part of the year. Should that become his permanent status now? He asked Martin for input. He was a good person to ask, really. During his leadership of Delirious, Smith played in more than 40 countries, sang lead and played guitar on 7 studio albums, supported bands as diverse as Bon Jovi and Switchfoot, and released songs that led the UK charts several times. If anyone was living John's dream, it was Martin. Maybe he'd provide a few pointers on how to navigate the exhilarating ride ahead. But that's not at all what transpired. There in the cafe that day, John had explained his predicament. He loved leading worship for our church, but the songs he was writing and performing were obviously anointed. Shouldn't he go chase the dream God was already making come true? Martin looked at him and said, "My advice to you is to go hide yourself in your church. Serve well in obscurity, and let God promote you at the right time. Don't go pursuing it on your own. The path will make you far less popular, but it will be worth it in the end." Martin has been honest about his motivations along the way. He led his band for nearly 2 decades and grew up morphing from boy to man there in the public eye. Delirious disbanded a few years ago, and in a recent interview, Martin reflected on what was going through his mind all that time. "I love doing this for God," he said, "but also I'd really like to be famous, really. You know, nothing we do is pure, is it, in our motive? I think there's always a bit of both going on. We wanted to be the next U2. We wanted God to meet people and people to meet God." This is always the tension as Christ's followers, isn't it? In our heart of hearts, we want to make God famous, even as we crave a tiny little bit of that fame for ourselves. John returned from that trip to the United Kingdom and did the very thing Martin had suggested. He re-upped his commitment here at home. In his words, he began viewing obscure service as peace not punishment. I could stand to take a lesson from this guy. Living right and well. This morning, as I met with God in prayer, I was asking Him about one of the burning desires of my own heart. There is something I believe God has called me to do, and it's something I believe I'm highly gifted to do. And yet, that something hasn't unfolded yet. I was throwing a pity party, to put it bluntly. I see other guys being given opportunities left and right to do this thing I believe I'm called and gifted to do. And yet, those opportunities aren't coming my way. I told God all of this, and then asked, "When is it my turn, God?" To which He said, "Nothing." There, in the silence, I thought about the vine and branches passage in John chapter 15, and about how what pleases God is not what we do, even though this thing is something I really, really want to do, but rather who we are. What pleases Him is that we stay close, that we stay hidden away in Him. It's true, when Jesus came up out of the waters of baptism at the beginning of His public ministry, God noted that this man was His Son, in whom, not by whom, He was well pleased. And as much as I sometimes hate to admit it, the same is true for me. It's never my performance God is after, even though I can be pretty good up on stage. It's my praise, and praise requires that I take my focus off myself and place it on what God is up to, on who He is instead. He is a God worthy of my praise. Along these lines, Isaiah 42 captures my imagination. It is this God, the one who created the cosmos, stretched out the skies, laid out the earth and all that grows from it, who breathes life into earth's people, who makes them alive with His own life. "I am God," the passage continues. "I have called you to live right and well. I have taken responsibility for you, kept you safe. I have set you among my people to bind them to me, and provided you as a lighthouse to the nations, to make a start at bringing people into the open, into light, opening blind eyes, releasing prisoners from dungeons, emptying the dark prisons. I am God. That's my name. I don't franchise my glory." Verses 5 through 8. And then this, a few verses later, referring to those who choose to stay connected to Him. "I'll be a personal guide to them, directing them through unknown country. I'll be right there to show them what roads to take, make sure they don't fall into the ditch. These are the things I'll be doing for them, sticking with them, not leaving them for a minute." Verses 15 and 16. God promises to stick with us when we accept the invitation to stick with Him. "This is the vine I've chosen. No decision has ever felt so right." Breaking busy. Challenge number 1. Hide yourself away. Today, dare to choose obscurity. When the opportunity presents itself for you to offer a kind word, do a good deed, or lend a helping hand, take it. And then comes the hard part. Don't brag about it, tweet about it, tell your spouse or friends about it, or insist in any manner on receiving glory for this very good thing you've done. Pay attention to how you feel hours later, after you've simply treasured up in your heart the beauty you brought to the world around you by serving instead of consuming, and then by letting all forms of self-congratulation simply slip on by. Challenge number 2. Praise God instead. Whenever you're tempted to self-promote today, focus on promoting God instead. If you find yourself dying to tell all your Facebook friends about the promotion you just received, stop and bow your head and thank God privately instead. When you are jittery with excitement about your kid's latest accomplishment and are about to text all your friends to that effect, stop and bow your head and praise God for your child instead. Let yourself remain in a bit of obscurity today, trusting that God will promote you at just the right time, and that His watchful eye is acknowledgement enough. Part 3. Determination. We live restored by practicing restoration. Nobody sees a flower, really. It is so small. We haven't time. And to see takes time. Like to have a friend takes time. Georgia O'Keeffe. Chapter 8. what to do on a do-nothing day. Be good. Keep your feet dry, your eyes open, your heart at peace, and your soul in the joy of Christ. Thomas Merton. How to do rest right. Despite the recent busyness battles I've fought of late, people who know me well know I've been on a rest kick lately, mostly for the purposes of writing this book. Staff meetings and lunchtime conversations and hallway chats all seem to chase back to this topic of rest, and before I know it, I've climbed back up onto my soapbox for the umpteenth time, ranting good-naturedly about the dangers of adrenal failure and what we can learn from Sabbath-happy Jews, and why whoever said there is no rest for the weary actually had it all wrong. In response come the questions, all centered on one primary theme. People want to know what a day of rest is supposed to include, what it shouldn't include, and whether it has to be a full day, as in 24 consecutive hours. They want to know if it's legal to take their kids to soccer practice or run by the grocery store or go to the movies on a day supposedly set aside to think about God. Regarding making a commitment to a regular bedhead day or even a bedhead hour for that matter, it seems the concern is not so much how do I do it, but rather how do I do it right. Dan Allender, as always, hits home. The mandate to rest from our work during the Sabbath is so slight and innocuous that it is boggling to the mind to consider how quickly questions come about how to do it right. Should the Sabbath begin on Friday at dusk, Saturday, or Sunday at sunrise? Does it need to be 24 hours, or could it be morning and a part of an afternoon? Can one drive a car, get gasoline, stop for takeout food, deliver food to a sick friend, shop online if no one is working, answer a phone? The war against delight rages the moment one puts the boundary between the Sabbath and all other time. The war involves guilt and shame-based demands that we do it right, so no one can accuse our motives or deeds, including God. To Allender's point, I've noticed that even the most free-spirited among us tend to want to know the score. We want to be assured that if we do X and add Y, then we'll get Z every time. We want to be guaranteed a predictable landing before we agree to take the plunge. A couple from church comes to mind. The mom and dad have four kids, all of whom are young adults. Along the way, the parents put the kids through the same strict paces. The kids were homeschooled and allowed only limited involvement in outside activities such as playing on sports teams or babysitting or hanging out with friends. When the kids reached teenage years, they were allowed only to court instead of date, which to the parents meant being very selective about who their kids were spending time with, how much time they were spending together, and what they were doing during that together time. The parents had been taught a purity formula somewhere along the way and decided that as long as they followed it to the letter, their kids would all turn out great. They'd whittled down parenting to a science, and they intended for each of their four experiments to prove their hypothesis right. Good training plus good boundaries equals good kid who finds good spouse and has good marriage each and every time. The first conversation I ever had with this couple occurred in my office after they'd requested a meeting about what to do with the disillusionment they were feeling toward God. Their eldest, a son, had been a perfect child, according to them, and had submitted joyfully to the rules and restrictions set for him throughout his life. Thankfully, they said, he courted a lovely young woman who also appreciated what they referred to as our way of life. The son wound up marrying the lovely young woman, which pleased this couple to no end. Their formula had worked. Good training plus good boundaries equals good kid who finds good spouse and has good marriage. How we love it when everything adds up. But everything didn't add up. 6 months into the marriage, the good spouse had an affair, a bad thing by anyone's standards, and left the good son for good. The parents of the good son now sat across from me, tears pooling in both sets of eyes. "This has been the most disappointing season of our lives," the mother began. "I mean, we followed all the principles." A colleague of mine was in the meeting with me, and as soon as he and I heard those words, we shared a knowing glance. This couple had done what we all tend to do. We reduce the human experience down to formulas, forgetting that life won't be contained in simple math. What this man and his wife were saying was, God owes us better than this result. X plus Y is supposed to equal Z. We want freedom, we think. As it relates to the idea of living rhythmically, too many people inside the church link arms with the formula-happy crowd. Once they're convinced a bit of rest might do them some good, they rush headlong into the undeniably non-restful practice of crafting and then enforcing a daunting list of thou shalt nots and thou shalts. They determine that rest should mean this and only this and not that, especially not that. It's a tightrope walk God never intended us to walk. In fact, it's legalism at its worst. Legalism is believing God is demanding something impossible of us, something we'll never in a million years achieve. It is the bar set too high, the speed set too fast, the expectation set too lofty, the boundaries set too tight. It is spiritual suffocation. It is darkness when we're desperate for light. I mow my lawn on many a day of rest and think nothing of the act. Come to think of it, some of my most sacred moments with God have occurred while perched on that fat riding mower seat. But I know people who get jittery when I reveal this dark secret of mine. Internally, I have always the same reaction. Seriously? You're up in arms over this? Yes, in fact they are. Not only are they convinced a divine demerit is headed my way, but they're also convinced I deserve it. They're legalists, through and through, whether they choose to admit it or not. My advice to us all, the legalists as well as those like me who shake our heads in astonishment at the restrictions legalists choose to rig up, is simply to live free. Be free. Focus on enjoying your rest. Kerry Wyatt Kent wrote, "Here's what Jesus seemed to be saying with his actions. You've heard it said to keep the Sabbath holy, which you've done by avoiding certain tasks. But I say to you, keep the Sabbath by engaging in relationship, by restoring people to community, to wholeness, by setting people free." And I'd add, we might try starting with ourselves. This is why people were outraged with Christ while he was here on the planet Earth, because he compromised rules to champion relationship. He healed on the Sabbath, remember? He also fed people on the Sabbath, trumpeted the coming kingdom.